There Is One by Gutman Lox. Part 2 of 6. 34. Consider. Life is a beautiful experience. We come into the world with a pure soul. The garden of choice is before us, and we are allowed to harvest what we will. We test and try the spectrum of opportunity, enjoying the fruits of creation. An inexhaustible amount of goodness lies before us. Food, water, love. There's always good to choose from. Then, when we finish our rounds, we go out of this world, finally relieved of its pulls and pushes, onto our rewards, may they be many, and punishments, may they be few. With such a simple task, with so much placed before us in such a holy place, why is it there is so much sorrow on the way? Do we not choose to be what we are? Have we not picked our courses? Then why have we chosen war and disease instead of peace and sharing? Are not both before us? Are our hands tied to pollution? When the Messiah comes, may his way be quickened, the exact type of people are here today will be here then also, the exact world. If this were not true, there could be no hope of bringing the Messiah now. If there had to be a different kind of people in a different kind of world, then we could not possibly bring the redemption now while this kind of people are here in this kind of world. But since we are told that our actions can bring the final redemption right now, we must be able to do it. So if we are able to bring peace, why have we chosen not to? A sheep is falling off a cliff. It is not aware of the consequences of its stumble. Then the kind and quick shepherd thrusts out his crook and hooks the stumbling sheep and pulls it hard onto a firm footing. To the sheep, the shepherd yanked its neck and caused it to cry, "I was only stumbling. Why did the shepherd act so cruelly? Is it not his job to save me?" Obviously, the shepherd was acting kindly and saved his charge from an ugly fall or even death. But the sheep was unaware of the entire picture. "Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me." The child runs between parked cars onto a busy street and evokes a parent's scream or slap. To the child, this reaction is vicious. To the parent, it is salvation. So it is with everyone. Although we see just a small segment of the stream, action is actually continuous. What is being experienced now is a continuation of what came before and what will go on. Each action feeds the continuation. A kindness births a kindness, and this kindness is the direct result of its parental action. This is the structure of the universe. To withhold the like reward of each action would confuse the global genetics. Right would not give birth to right, and wrong would not give birth to wrong. Apple seeds would grow into pears, and pears would grow into leaves. War to the soldiers to gain freedom, to the farmer hell, to the general glory, to the vanquished slavery, and to peace death. All experience an individual perspective which recognizes only personal feelings. But globally, the view is broader, and in the end it is seen that the apparent evil was ultimately for the good. When Israel sinned, God said he would bring a people from the north to lay siege against us. These people did not consider themselves to be messengers of God. They embarked upon their journey of death and destruction, motivated by greed. In the end, God deals with them also, as he smites the smiter. When God sent Moses to Pharaoh, Pharaoh would not listen, for God hardened his heart. Did Pharaoh choose the destruction that came upon Egypt? What choice did Pharaoh have? It was God who hardened his heart. Yes, but God hardened the heart of someone who previously had hardened his heart against God. And this hardening was required to satisfy that hardening. Does this mean that we are caught up in eternal wheel of destruction to satisfy some ancient evil act? No. Each of us can choose again. The soul you have given within me is pure. The Son will not die for the sins of the Father. Granted, it is more difficult to choose righteousness while being reared in an unrighteous environment, but it can be done. God is all forgiving, and the tiniest good deed, the briefest gesture of kindness, the scantest hint of love cannot go unrewarded. You and I have it clearly within our power to turn the entire world in a moment by simply loving one another. 35. Consider. To love someone is to realize that you are that someone. To lust after someone is to realize that you are not that someone. 36. Consider. Shimon the Levi was born and raised in London. He was a product of his time, and as such, he reached into everything available to his generation. Cults, drugs, ear-shattering music, the mystical East, the hippie West, and then the Wild West. Finally, here in the Wild West, he found what he was looking for. It was billed as the largest gathering of tribal brothers ever to have taken place in England. The meadow was leased, and the campsites were prepared. The major attraction was a genuine American Indian chief brought over to guide all of the brothers in their natural art of living on the land, survival as it was and could be while simply living in a meadow. The brothers gathered wearing buckskin loincloths and headbands. They all had the official braids of hair running down their backs, bright feathers and tomahawks in their belts. Peace pipes were passed around most of the day. The chief stood, arms crossed, overseeing his vast army of white red men. Shimon stood next to the chief, hanging on to his every word. "You see all these men?" the chief asked. Shimon nodded, expecting to hear something profound. "They're all lost." Shimon's face dropped. The chief continued, "They don't know what tribe they come from." Shimon was completely confused. Had he heard these words from his parents or a rabbi, he would have been able to dismiss them. But coming from the chief himself, he was left totally defenseless. The chief looked Shimon in the eye and asked him, "Do you know what tribe you come from?" Shimon was taken aback. But then he remembered, "My father is a Levi. He is from the tribe of Levi. So I am a Levite. I know my tribe. I am a Levi." He turned at that very moment and began his journey to Yerushalayim, where he now studies Talmud with sidelocks instead of braids, a tallis instead of a loincloth, a yarmulke instead of a feather, and his songs are in Hebrew instead of Soy or Cherokee. He says he's a very fortunate man. 37. Consider. An American Jew was working as a clerk in a small craft shop. A Japanese customer was startled by the American's knowledge of the Japanese language. "Ah, you speak Japanese," the customer said, bowing his head somewhat as he spoke. The American returned the hint of a bow and said, "A little. I studied many years ago while in Japan. I learned to read and write some while studying at the Buddhist monastery." "Ah, so." The customer was quite amazed. "You studied Buddhism?" "A little," was the proper, humble reply. "But didn't you have your own religion?" 38. Consider. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Now, why did Hashem apparently create the heaven first? Here on earth, when we build a house, we begin with the lower level first. Yes, but from Hashem's point of view, heaven is the foundation of the earth. As it says, "Build it according to the form which I showed you on the mount." Here, Moses was being instructed about the construction of the tabernacle, to build it according to the pattern that he was shown while on Mount Sinai. Hashem revealed to Moses the spiritual tabernacle, which already existed. Hashem builds with the more refined first, as with light on the first day and the firmament on the second. But how then it is that the Sabbath follows the six mundane days of the week? How is it that this holy day was revealed last? Because Sabbath is a crown, and in order to have a crown in place, there must first be a body. Without a kingdom, there is no king. The holiness of the Sabbath includes all that transpires during the week. The crown sits upon the top of the head over the entire body. Sabbath begins exactly at sundown Friday evening. However, the preparations go on throughout the entire week. New clothes are purchased with Sabbath in mind. The tablecloth is prepared. Food is brought home to cook the favorite dishes. Guests, all important, must be invited or the children will be out on the street at the last minute calling out, "Excuse me, sir, do you have a place for Sabbath?" Clean the floors, polish the shoes, walk quickly. The holy bride, Sabbath, is coming. Father comes home early and whisks off to the mikveh. The street is filled with rushing people. "Shabbos, Shabbos," the day calls out. "Walk quickly, the holy queen is coming." The last minute runs, the bakery before it closes. Oh, how will I ever be ready? 4 challahs, please, and a good-sized piece of that coffee cake. Mommy has a new baby, and we don't have time to bake. Walk quicker, the sun is going down. Father and the boys have returned from the mikveh and are going to daven mincha. Shabbat shalom, Shabbat shalom. The call precedes the day. Evening is falling quietly. The cars have stopped, and only a few people are left to scurry home. Shabbat shalom. It is time to light the candles. The women and girls gather around the candles, and a sense of awe brings a welcome calm. Is everything done that must be done before the lighting? The children drop a few coins in the charity box. Little fingers learn quickly. There is a hush as the candles are lighted, a sigh, and breath of release. The ushering in of the Sabbath, the crown, and reason has come. Mother draws the light to her face and recites the blessing softly. She looks like an angel with light all over her face. She pauses, eyes closed, and places our heartfelt hopes before the king. The prayers to welcome the bride fill the city. Even the birds seem to join in. "Welcome, Queen Sabbath. Come in peace." The prayers are joyfully longer than usual, and more dancing is common. Gray beards dancing. Is there any greater sight? Ya da 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 dee. The melody goes on. The words have long since left the lips, but the melody refuses to die. Ya ya da da dee da yum bum bum. Dee da yum bum bum. The service concludes and the quiet stroll home begins. Smiles come easily as one greets his fellow. Shabbat shalom, Shabbat shalom. The stride is gentle and the children have no trouble keeping up. The joyful tunes file out of the lighted windows and dance along the street. Small children hold their father's hands and touch them to their cheeks. It's Sabbath. There's always time to touch on Sabbath. Home is reached and the door is open as if by prayer. The waiting children who stayed home know their father's footsteps and are eager to see his face. Shabbat shalom, Shabbat shalom. The greetings are exchanged while small children take a seat or scurry for a lap to sit upon. The table is set and the meal is prepared. Let us welcome the angels who have escorted us home this evening. The song begins. Peace unto you, ministering angels, messengers of the Most High, the Supreme King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He. The song arouses anticipation. Next, a woman of valor is sung, and although it is well known that this refers to the Jewish people, everyone looks at the mother, thinking it is also speaking specifically about her. Kiddush, the sanctification of the day over wine, follows. The cold wine overflows the cup, splashing onto the saucer. Songs flow easily on Sabbath. The hands are washed, and an almost solemn moment comes. The challahs, clothed in a beautiful cloth, have been placed before the head of the house. He pauses, quietly uncovers the loaves, lifts them in the air, and blesses God with thanksgiving and joy. The bread is divided into pieces and dipped 3 times in salt, and the piece is quickly eaten. Jackets come off, top hats are placed away from the careless sitters, belts are loosened, and an exquisite feast begins. If only every Jew would observe 2 Sabbaths in a row, the Messiah would come. During the meal, the most learned will lead a discussion on the weekly portion of the Torah. The children will explain something they learned during the week, and a guest will contribute what they have heard from a great rabbi or some lesson they have learned. Special Sabbath songs filled with mystical allusions or songs without words elevate and wind around the room, entwining souls and voices like flames yearning upward. The evening passes quickly and the children fall off to sleep. It's getting late now, we had better bench. The after-dinner prayers are over and the guests are walked part way home. Father and mother scoop the children into bed and the Sabbath sleep has come. 39. Consider. Indeed, the 1700s were a strange time in the history of the Jewish people. The yeshivas were at a peak of keenness. Great gaonim were almost commonplace. The sharp swords of genius clashed against each other, honing razor sharp. This is the way to understand this section, one scholar would sing across the table. His partner would sing back a little louder. But over here in this section it says, and back and forth the duel would continue until a clear understanding would emerge. The cities housing these yeshivas flourished, and the Jews in these cities prospered. But there came upon these learned Jews a strange and haughty attitude. Somehow, as they reached new heights of Torah learning, they began to consider themselves totally removed from the unlearned Jews of the country, the farmers, the smiths, the peddlers. It is not that these scholars forgot that we are one, but they believed that since the head is above the heart, it had a right to look down upon it. The arms and legs became a source of disdain. This was the state of affairs. Only the learned was the real Jew. The illiterate became an aberration, a half-Jew. Then came a great tidal wave that would ultimately wash away this arrogance and replace it with a humble joy. A joy that the simplest person could know, and it could be found right in his own heart. Like most tidal waves, this one began with a relatively unnoticeable beginning. There was a man named Israel ben Eliezer, born in 1698. He posed as an unlearned and simple Jew. As an orphaned youth, he loved to spend his time under the green trees of the forest instead of sitting in the great houses of learning. One of his first jobs was to lead the small children to cheder. This he did with song and dance and turned what to others was a boring task into the highlight of the day. The children loved it, and they adored their musical guide. This turning of tedious life to joy began a pattern that was to repeat itself until ultimately magnifying itself over a goodly portion of European Jewry. The singing and dancing spread from the forest to the village, to the town, and even into the cities. With it came an ancient doctrine reborn. The simplest act done by even the most ignorant person could be elevated to the Most High, the Holiest of Holies, when this act was done in the service of God and with gladness of heart. He taught to forget the hardships of life around and to remember that God is within everyone and everything, and in fact, there is nothing else besides God. He emphasized first joy and self-respect, then could come Torah education, ultimately revealing its deepest secrets to even the simplest of Jews. Because of the miracles attributed to him, he became known as the Master of the Good Name, the Baal Shem Tov. His doctrine spread, filling the vacuum created by arrogance. Although his way was blocked by many, including foreign governments who feared his popular movement, and by learned Jews who feared his apparent lack of learning, His teachings have flourished to this day. His opposition has become his servants, and his followers have become the Hasidim. 40. Consider. Everyone has a story, but the Baal Teshuva has two. His life and ways before and after returning to a life directed by Torah precepts. As the Baal Teshuva returns, his soul is in a rare state. On earth, the soul is swimming towards its source, while in the heavens, the tide has turned and the angels are dancing before God. There is great rejoicing as the world moves closer towards its final redemption, and man shall learn war no more. 41. Consider. Reb Mendel. Reb Mendel is a chassid of the Rebbe. While living in Russia, Reb Mendel was sent into internal exile to Siberia. He had been caught by the secret police building mikvahs and was forced to live in exile in extreme hardship. After many long years, he was finally to be released. He and his wife went to the train station to await the only train to freedom. While waiting, Reb Mendel saw an old Jew sitting on the ground crying. He listened while the old man explained that he, too, was to have been released that day, but the police came and had taken away his papers at the train station. Reb Mendel told his wife to get on the train ahead of him and then gave his papers to the old man. The old man took Reb Mendel's seat and the train pulled away, separating Reb Mendel from his wife for 11 years. Reb Mendel tells the following story. We can learn what type of Jew we should become by the way a Cossack takes his horse. He begins by running a wild pack of horses for 3 days and nights until the horses become totally exhausted. Then he forces the herd into a raging river. The river, swollen from recent rains, carries most of them away. Only a few make it to the far shore, and almost all of these will continue their flight for freedom, running as fast as their exhausted bodies will allow. Of all the horses that began the chase, there will be only one or two that neither drown nor keep running after reaching safety. These animals make it to the far shore, then turn around and plunge themselves back into the raging river in order to rescue their struggling companions. These are the horses they pick, and this is the type of Jew we must become. It is not enough to make it through the raging world ourselves. We must be prepared to jump back into the turmoil to help our drowning people make it to safety, to the peaceful shore. 42. Consider. A mezuzah is a parchment on which a scribe has painstakingly inscribed the proper portions of the Torah. To affix mezuzahs on Jewish doorposts is one of the 613 commandments given to the Jewish people. You shall inscribe them upon the doorpost of your houses and upon your gates. On the west coast of the United States, a father sent his young son to Talmud Torah. The boy became fascinated with his bearded teacher and took everything he said to heart. One day the teacher told the class the story of a very powerful king who sent a very expensive gift to a rabbi whom the king admired. The rabbi in turn sent the king a mezuzah. Upon seeing the rabbi's gift, the king furiously sent a burning message to the rabbi. How dare he send the king a worthless parchment after receiving such an expensive gift? The rabbi quickly returned this answer to the king. The gift you sent me is certainly extremely valuable. In fact, it is so valuable that I must stay up at night and guard it. However, the gift that I sent to you is even more valuable because it stays up at night and guards you. The boy loved this story and understood its meaning. He ran home for money to buy proper mezuzahs for the entire house. His father, like many American Jews, felt that Judaism, with all of its rules, was fine for the children, but once you had to make a living, all else was no longer important. "Don't bother me with that stuff," he admonished. "Those rules are fine while you're growing up, but once you're in the world, it's a different story." So he refused the boy the money. The boy persisted, But what if I take my own money that I earn, then can I buy a mezuzah and put it up on my bedroom, on my doorpost? The father agreed, and the boy did just that. He earned the money doing odd jobs, and finally he got a kosher mezuzah and affixed it to his bedroom doorpost. A short time later, the father purchased a new car. It was apparently wired incorrectly and caught on fire one night while parked in the garage, directly under the boy's room. Smoke filled the bedroom, but the boy awakened and managed to sound the alarm. The family safely escaped and stood outside, watching the flames consume most of the house in minutes. Only the boy's room remained, and it was not touched by a single flame. The firemen arrived and sprayed water on the hot ashes. They said that they had never seen such a thing. The boy's room should have been the first to go. They said it was a miracle, and the father agreed. That night, he said, I will never sleep in another room that doesn't have a mezuzah on the doorpost. 43. Consider. A chassid of the Rebbe had a serious problem. His foot ached so much he could hardly walk. He went to several specialists who could find nothing wrong. At last he wrote the Rebbe about his problem. The Rebbe replied that he should check his mezuzahs to ensure that they were kosher, that they were properly written. The chassid felt so strongly about the Rebbe's advice that he immediately purchased new mezuzahs and gave the old ones away. Lo and behold, his foot recovered and he felt wonderful. But the poor fellow who received his old mezuzahs began to limp with the same problem. Seeing this, the chassid took all the mezuzahs to a qualified scribe to be inspected. They were amazed to discover a tiny imperfection in the foot of the letter Tav, and the word Uvelechtecha was separated from the rest of the letter, making the mezuzah invalid. Uvelechtecha means as you walk. 44. Consider. In the 1960s, the Western world underwent a volcanic social change. The 60s found the West in a period of explosive introspection, hallucinogenics, resistance to government, and the appearance of the hippies led the West on a rather romantic rampage. As with many infatuations, the early idealism ended up, for the most part, being misleading rather than enlightening. And as all explosions, time picks up the pieces while civilization digests its growling changes and the survivors march on to their doom. These times saw many young people go through two distinct changes. First, a recognition that they did not have to accept the established authority just because it was there. And secondly, an attempt to replace the establishment with an idealistic Garden of Eden. Clearly, the early emphasis was more on the idol than on the ideal. As with most social quick changes, Jews were disproportionately represented, and many leaders of the leaderless movement were in fact Jews. In retrospect, many Jews who experienced the 1960s explained that they looked at their parents and saw financial success, but spiritual bankruptcy. Those who turned to the local synagogue found that the material priority had completely taken over. There was no spiritual nourishment, just buy a seat and be seen. So they began to look elsewhere to fill the void. Drugs wore thin. The dream was to find a natural high and to stay up forever. Exercises, hyperventilation, diets, fasting, meditation, twirling. The list seemed endless, from the watermelon fast to the coffee enema. Seeking always for the spiritual high that would free the individual from the endless waves of highs and lows into the limitless bliss or the internal zero. With a little bit of help from my friends, many young people ended up in ashrams in India, following and allowing a guru to rule their lives. Eastern religious leaders flocked to the West, eager to pick up the devotees and especially their discarded material wealth. The gurus became rich, while the devotee was left with a perpetual half-smile. Many Jews ended up wasting 10 to 15 years of their precious lives, cleaving to leaders who when ultimately exposed, were seen to be demented. What was lacking the Jewish home, the Jewish school, and the Jewish houses of worship that these young people felt forced to seek God elsewhere? What can be done to prevent another generation from repeating this costly mistake? Jewish life with the home as its center must be a spiritual sanctuary, a place where love is demonstrated by providing spiritual as well as physical comfort. As a child must be securely tucked into his bed at night, so must his soul feel securely tucked into its purpose in life. The child must be made aware that he is on a journey and given guidance as to how it can be safely accomplished. This life is the antechamber, and we must prepare for the future life while there is time. Certainly a loving mother teaches her child not to run into the street. She must also explain how good deeds go on beyond this world, into the coming world and into the world to come. Without a sense of past and future, life can easily take on a merely physical perspective. Without our history, we're like victims of amnesia, left to float into whatever gives us momentary pleasure. Without a sense of the world to come, we may not realize that there will be repercussions to our actions. Imagine a person diving into an empty swimming pool. If one considers just the instant, the dive itself is the same with or without water. It's irrelevant whether the leap into the air ends in a refreshing bath or a very sudden stop in a pile of concrete. So it is with daily life. Each action creates a following action, which in turn continues to bring about another action. This is true spiritually as well as physically, for nothing is physical without its spiritual roots. This spiritual awareness is what was lacking in the Jewish home, school, and synagogue. The Jewish home needs mezuzahs to promote Jewish awareness. With mezuzahs, there's a daily reminder. But this alone will not guarantee that our children will grow securely protected within the fences decreed by our rabbis. For even children who have grown in such environments can still become lost and end up wandering. But mezuzahs will help, and so will maintaining a kosher kitchen, as will observing all of the directives of the Torah. But however much the physical directives help, without a concentrated effort to also accomplish the spiritual directives, the home will run the risk of becoming a restrictive prison, with the children dreaming of the day when college or an early marriage will be a passport to freedom. How many religious homes seem dark and stiff because the physical is painstakingly observed, while the spiritual is left totally ignored? The physical must be seen to be an extension of the spiritual to be elevated. The physical mezuzah must remind the spiritual will to take its message to heart. Without the spiritual follow-up, the physical becomes just another burden. All of the Torah's directives have to be followed physically, but not merely physically. To give charity with an open hand, but with a closed heart, does not fulfill the commandment. And even though credit will be given for what was given, it will be noted that only the physical charity was given, and not the love that is also commanded. A journey of a million years cannot be understood by looking at a watch. A keen sense of the past and enlightened view of the future must be employed. Know where you are coming from and to where it is you go. 45. Consider, what is life? Is it just a dream? Can the instant have meaning, so brief amidst so vast a span? Is it important to do good, or can we escape through sleep? Will time let us go? Many philosophers throughout the ages have let us swing from not existing at all to existing in a helpless, endless abyss. Who is right? Do I? Am I? Is it? The mind is a sharp knife that can cut away the darkness of delusion or sever its owner from the physical world, left to float helplessly in the void of endless space. The life before creation, the life that is creation, and the eternal life that goes on beyond creation is the same one, unchanged life. It is. It creates, it fills, and it will dissolve. None of it is unjust, no matter what court decides otherwise, and none of it is wasted. The moment is essential and cannot be discounted just because it has been neglected. Life is our being. What appears as the individual body is a vehicle for moving through creation. Although it carries individual consciousness, it is not separate from the field it travels. It moves as if it were, but the field is continuous and includes the individual. Seated behind the mind, we push our will into the world, unfolding our lives. How we judge ourselves and our surroundings determines which actions we will take. As the images flow in, it is important to remind ourselves of the purpose of this journey. Life is indifferent to our choice, but it is not indifferent to our reward. Choose your step, walk where you will, but know that footprints are set and the second step will have a propensity towards the direction set by the first step. So choose carefully. It is easier to keep from taking the first step than it is to stop the second. A bull can be kept from running much easier than it can be made to stop once it has begun. Life is as simple as now and as complex as infinity. There are no contradictions in truth. Heat and cold are expressions of the same measure. The words God and man are also an expression of measure and do not indicate a contradiction. Here it is called man, and here it is called God. Both do not exist side by side, but rather they are one. As a person who points to his chest can say, "This is my chest," or he can say, "This is me." These are merely statements of perspectives. Time is the one thing that cannot be made up once it is wasted. A thrown-away dollar can be found later or replaced, but a day without love or rest, without helping or joy, is gone forever. We are allotted a set amount of time to accomplish what is required of us. If we fail, we will have to come back to do it again. This is why a baby cries at birth, but one only sighs at death. How can we waste time? Is not the year filled with the same 365 1/4 days, no matter how we spend it? Waste does not necessarily imply discarding something useful. It can also imply absence. To live alone is a waste. It is not good for man to live alone. To not have children is a waste. Imagine a tree without a seed or a way to propagate. Be fruitful and multiply. To be unduly sad is waste. Serve the Lord with joy. It can mean that progress was retarded or that the opportunity to help was discarded. When the soul is judged in heaven after its tour on earth, it will be held accountable not only for those things that were overtly wrong, but also for the permitted, joyous things it could have done but chose not to. Life's purpose is joy. 46. Consider. The mind, itself a reflection or function of will, supplies information from the gross perceptions of the world and projects this information before the eye. For example, an apple on the table is seen by the eye, physical eye, which the mind directs. The image of the apple is then presented to the eye as an I am, which is also called the self, witness, or me. The I am and the mind are not the two separate aspects they first appear to be. Deeper, more concentrated meditation will reveal that the I, as in I am, and the mind are actually one. The mind is simply a mechanism or position of the I. The relationship can be compared to the focusing lens of a camera or a wagon driver and his horses. With just a small command, the driver can direct the horses into frenzied action so that he lurches forward with the wagon. Sometimes it seems like the driver is actually a helpless prisoner in a wagon dragged forward by wild horses. But actually the driver gives the commands and the horses are his servants. Similarly, man can feel helplessly driven by a raging mind when in truth he himself is driving his mind forward. 47. Consider. self versus ego. The self is the being, and the ego is the appraisal of the being. The self is the I, as in I am, which is unchanging, while the appraisal changes from moment to moment. When the average person reflects upon his life, he generally considers himself to be the collection of experiences and abilities he can remember. When asked, "Who are you?" the normal first reply will be his name, Joseph. But who is Joseph? I am Joseph so-and-so. I live here. I work here. I am married to her and the father of them. Always answering by nomenclature, extremities, identifiable by external observations. When pushed to consider himself other than in relationship to his wife, children, or position, Joseph will move on to his opinion of himself. I am a happy man who does good and loves animals. Although Joseph is now moving in on himself, he is still discussing his deeds or desires as opposed to the self. An easy exercise to help in the process of self-understanding is to write or recite a paragraph about yourself in the normal sense. In Joseph's case, I am a happy man, I do good, I love animals, and I am going to work. Now, repeat the paragraph, changing the word I to the word it. This will move the focus from the ego I to a more objective it. In Joseph's case, it is a man, it does good, it loves animal, and it is going to work. The sharp boundary of I is somewhat released and allows for a broader perspective. Once Joseph can comfortably see that the boundaries of the I can be released without any great death or catastrophe, he will be ready to move on to a greater understanding of the self. Life can be objectively considered as one life living on the planet, crawling here and dying there. Joseph can easily feel comfortable as an example of it, i.e., life on the face of the earth. It is here and it is there. Easy. This trend of thought allows you to consider the ego more objectively and moves the blame and pride formerly affixed to ego onto the whole. That is, life is doing good here or evil there. This in no way diminishes the consequences of our actions. Good will come where good is done, and evil will bring evil to its doers, as it says, because they turn their face from me. I will hide my face from them. But reflecting on the I, as it, will broaden one's scope and ultimately allow one to realize God is all. Blessed be the life of all the worlds. To what avail is this search? To realize that you are also your neighbor will make you somewhat more forgiving of him. And once you can forgive, it becomes very easy to love. Your being, if considered to be solely you, is just like a finger that attests to it being only a finger, incapable of seeing itself as the hand, or extremity, or the life that is. Because life is eternal, and not like ego, which comes and goes, many people make the serious mistake of declaring that there is no ego. This is wrong as saying that the table or the wall does not exist. True, when viewed deeply, the table or wall is seen to be molecules, but we can no more deny the table's existence than we can deny the existence of the molecules. Even after we view more subtly and the molecules and atoms have disappeared from view, still the molecules are there, just as is the table. The objects being seen do not change with our perspective. The ego, as the table, has a role to perform. Without a purpose, it would not be here. And for all things have their place. The ego must be elevated as well as the table. The table comes as an altar for holy service, while the ego becomes the son or servant of the Holy King. Once we realize that the table is molecules, we do not discard it. Similarly, knowing that the ego is a function of mind, we need not throw it away. The ego is useful, and we need not spend years of fasting or exercise trying to get rid of it. Merely identify the function, then use it for good. Eventually, when the ego is seen to be what it actually is, a mere opinion, it will lapse like a knot untied or a lap when standing. 48. Consider. It is by change or contrast that something can be known. A star can be measured only in relationship to something else, or to itself at a different moment. The unchanging, the fixed, cannot be measured. So how then can God be known? As it says, "And you shall know the Lord." The only way to know the unchanging is by experience, by existence. The inescapable truth is that nothing exists besides God. Therefore, even the simplest experience of life must be God. However, when contemplating God as the unchanging, one cannot use thought or mind or even intuition, as these tools are far too gross to even attempt to approach the unapproachable. This is why it is said that nothing can be known beyond the level of emanation. To know, in this sense, is to contain, understand, or discuss. These require form, and thus are further along the descent towards the formed or concrete. However, one can realize that one's experience is God's experience, since God is all. This is knowing the unknowable. This is being what you are, and realizing that the truth, from any perspective, is that there is no one here besides God. What we experience is but a tiny speck within the spectrum of existence, but is still existence. Just as the tiniest drop of the ocean is still ocean, so is our tiniest experience existence. What we experience is unbelievably small compared to the whole of creation, and creation is but a tiny ray of a ray of Him. Yet we must not think of the tiny drop as only a part of the ocean, but imagine pointing to a drop while it is in the ocean and realizing that we are pointing at the ocean. Although the drop can be identified as a separate drop by defining its borders, while it is in the ocean, it is ocean. So it is with all creation. Although a man may be pointed to and defined as a man, he may also be pointed to as a person, or life, or stuff, or molecules, or we may in fact be intending to point to the place that is everywhere. Place is God. The light from the sun is also the sun. Although it is hotter and brighter closer to the center of the globe itself, the light that forms what appears to be the globe is no more or less an aspect of the sun than is the light that falls upon the earth. So it is with the manifestations of God. As the manifestations become more and more concentrated or gross, they do not become less God. 49. Consider, all that exists is God. As it says, there is nothing else. Yet what we see in existence is always changing. How can there be one? How can we say the formless, unchanging God is one with the temporary, formed world we experience? How can we say the table is God? God is everywhere. Do I not fill the heavens and the earth, he says? The table cannot be excluded from God. When we identify the table, we are pointing out a specific visible perspective. By calling it table, we are not excluding its wood, atoms, energy, light, or place. Place is one of the names of God, but table is not. Why? Because the table is not all. The table is not the chair, nor is it the floor, nor is anything other than the table. The place, however, is everywhere. Omnipresent. When we say God has no form, we are not excluding the appearance from form from creation. We are stating that God is all, and that which has form, that which we have limited by definition, is not all. Of course, God includes all, but it could be very misleading to say God is the table, even though in truth, God includes the table. This is how to reconcile the fact that form changes and God does not change, while still including even the changing formed creation. The shapes change, but the all is not changing in essence. We learn in the Torah that God reveals himself in different ways at different times. We know God created different things at different times, yet we do not consider this behavior to be changes in God. Likewise, apparent changes in his creation do not constitute changes in himself, just in his actions. The plan of God in creation is to allow the appearance of change to occur. This is how the movement of something from nothing. This is the continuation of the Hebrew letters Yud-Keh to Vav-Keh of his name, the design and purpose of creation. Before creation, there was no emanation, no movement. Movement is the focusing of will that causes creation and is the foundation of apparent change in the universe. Imagine an eye that sees in all directions at once, and it can also see the entire place of creation. At any particular moment, it may focus more intensely on a specific aspect or area of the place. By doing this, its entire view has not changed, but by increasing its attention on that specific aspect, it will in fact cause that portion of creation to come into being. This increasing of focus is, in fact, will. And it is by will that God creates, while not limiting or changing in the least. Since the object created was potentially always there, God merely moved it along by willing it into actualization. If God would remove his sustaining will at any moment, there would be nothing at all remaining, since God's will is all that is really here. Like a dying man's thoughts, once he passes away, with nothing left to sustain his thoughts, the images cease. 50. Consider. Once there was a famous rabbi whose time to pass away had come. He gathered his students around for the last time and began to weep. Amazed, they asked why so great a holy person could weep as death approached. He answered that he wept not because death was at hand. His sorrow was due to his imminent departure from a world where for just a few pennies he could buy some strings and satisfy the will of the Holy One, blessed be he. Here we are in a physical world where the will of the master of all can easily be known, and even more easily fulfilled. Imagine a peasant who wanted to improve his lot by doing something for the king of the land. How could he even hear from the king, let alone carry out his wishes? Now we are being promised more than the king's daughter if only we fulfill his pleasant commands. We are guaranteed every blessing in this world, plus an exalted place in the world to come. No earthly king's blessings can even approach these rewards. 51. Consider. Do time and space exist? What may at first seem simple or foolish can confound. Does 7 exist? 12? The quick answer is 7 or 12 what? But that would be discussing the nature of the what, not the nature of 7. For us, 7 can exist only in relationship. 7 days or 7 heavens do exist, but 7 cannot be said to exist by itself. Even as a concept, numbers cannot be said to exist. The concept exists, not the numbers. Numbers are measurements that can be applied to things, but have no independent existence. Time is also a measurement, and without a creation, it cannot be said to exist. Time measures change, and without something to change, there can be no time. What is usually meant by time is the occurrence of change in creation. These changes are said to occur in space, which is also only a measure. Without something to measure, there cannot be any space. For a clearer understanding of space, compare it to place. Before space could come, there had to be a place to put it. Place, however, as one of the names of God, must have the characteristics of God. It must be everywhere and not have been created. 52. Consider, sorrow is a thief, and if it is not arrested, it will steal more than physical possessions. It will steal health and eventually even life. In proper measure, sorrow has its place. As it says, there's a time to weep. But the next thought there is a time to laugh. This teaches that to each sorrow there's an end, and laughter will follow. The person who's unjustifiably sad throughout his life, or even for a single day, should humbly consider why the gates of repentance have been closed to him. When seeing something cruel in the world, sadness might well be the appropriate response. However, when what is happening is not actually cruel or unjust, then the sad response is unjustified. Often, we are locked into what might be an accurate response to an inaccurate appraisal. To respond sadly furthers the delusion by increasing suffering, which in turn reinforces even more suffering. The day is such. A tree, an apple falling, a flower, a rainstorm, an animal eats its noon meal, a bird flies by, the sun breaks through the clouds, a man walks down the road, a father corrects his child, a woman waves goodbye to a friend. Life is coming and going. One could also see a tree. It is blocking the garden from the needed sunlight. An apple falling. Why can't I get around to making juice from all those apples by my tree? They make such a mess. A flower. This means bees, and bees sting, and so on. So goes the unrepentant, sad person seeing what is just there through darkened eyes. The person who's unduly sad is forgetting that God is the cause and is disjointing a particular action from the flow it really is into a separate self-causing act. By recognizing that each action has a previous cause which produces the following result, the value judgment of that action is somewhat removed. The boy cries. Without the proper perspective, this seems sad. But when we know the reason for the crying, be it he cut onions or lost a pet, it is not that he is crying that is sad, but that his eyes sting or that his pet is lost. Then as we find out that the pet was actually taken to be vaccinated, we feel sad because the boy did not know. Finally, when we discover the boy's father knew that the boy would not allow the pet to be taken, so he took it while the boy was not looking, we recognize that it was all an act of kindness. So it is with each action. It is not an isolated experience to be judged individually, but rather an integral portion of an entire series of events that should only be judged as successive and just. In the end, it will be seen that what appears to be evil is actually for the good. 53. Consider. The prayer says, strengthen us, purify us, awesome one. The first letters of each of these words in Hebrew forms the abbreviation STN, from which is derived the name Satan. To many nations of the world, Satan is a separate power or an angel, quite powerful and free to do battle with God in a never-ending struggle for control of the souls and even bodies of man. Satan is given a form by these nations, usually a red person to show lust, heat, or anger, with horns to exemplify animal weapons and a tail to show his animal inclination. Many of these anthropomorphic illusions are, well, attributed to this aspect of life. The evil inclination does indeed thrive on the heat of anger and lust, and it certainly does seem to be an animal from top to bottom. However, this is where the homiletical analogies stop and where idolatry begins. Satan is not a separate power, nor an angel with independent will. It is merely a function of God placed within the scheme of life to strengthen us and purify us. As gold is heated to separate the pure from the dross, as clothing is beaten or agitated to be washed, as exercise is strengthened, so does God create this function to cause man to overcome and thereby excel. To yell at dysfunction is like a dog who barks and bites at the stick he is being bitten with, while totally ignoring the man who wields the stick. God sends us these temptations and struggles as choices. When we choose evil, God justly sends the troubles that follow. Without this cause and effect, we would be totally lost to behave randomly. It is the repercussions of our deeds that guide us. Good brings good, and evil brings evil. Without these like results, the world would be totally confused, and life would have no meaning. As it says, and God created after its kind. Thereisone.com